Today being a long day. What is your name?
I'm Natalie.
Natalie. How was your day?
It was lovely. Okay. Yeah. Mostly.
Good. Anyone have any questions from today's practice you'd like to share? For example, the freestyle meditation that we did. Maybe you have questions about the walking or the last period of sitting.
When we were outside in the freestyle, I was doing it with a visual object, mm-hmm. and I realized that whenever I meditate with my eyes open, I'm basically doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of interesting, but it was interesting to do it outside, and I wasn't sure whether to sort of focus on something or to leave my gaze soft and unfocused.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a particular technique?
When we do the direct contemplation, we're using eyes to see. We just look at it.
Okay.
We don't really draw in our awareness inward and just maybe not see or let it go out of focus. We actually engage with that which is seen. Were you drawn in when you see? Like in sitting meditation? So in meditation, our eyes are open, but we actually may not see anything.
Right. I was more engaged, even though my gaze was not as focused on one.
Yeah. Okay.
It's sort of fun.
Okay. Did you discover anything inside you?
I felt it was very peaceful.
Okay.
I was aware of not being of the forms that the what I was seeing turned into more like just sensations, not oh there's some water, the wind is blowing over it, and there's a branch moving in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of lost track of all that. It was just sensations.
Okay. Huh? I'm going to ask a little more question. How is the sensations? What do you mean by sensations?
Colors, shapes, movement.
Mm-hmm. Perceptions.
Perceptions, yeah.
Okay. Sensation, we usually we reserve that for kind of tactile sensations.
Oh.
Yeah. Pleasurable, unpleasurable, mm-hmm. neutral. Okay. You're waiting to
say? Yes, I was going to say my object was visual. It was a long shoot of grass gone to seed, and mm-hmm. it was swaying in the breeze. And you had just talked to us about being more grounded. I told you about my eyes,
mm-hmm.
my expression. You said that's because you need to be more grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And without conceptualizing it, this piece of grass was blowing in the breeze,
mm-hmm.
and yet remaining rooted, and suddenly I just understood what you had taught me very well about being grounded but not, you know, being free too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We all seen these Dharma dolls, one of these dolls use air to blow up, and then on the bottom is maybe sand. You punch it and that's one way to understand being grounded.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else from over here? Yes. As in.
Is there a reason to say pick one, visual or sound? Because I find myself to feel its tranquility and joy. That it seems like I just give myself up, and then what I receive is multiple. It's not one sound or sight. Just one little exercise. It takes one they go and one's done. Is there any reason for that?
The reason primarily is just to simplify the experience. But it is natural that all sounds start to come in. As long as one is stable and remain in the simplicity of the moment, not being swayed by them, then it's fine. But if I were to give the instruction of pick, you know, all sounds, then some people may find it a little more difficult. They start to pick and choose. Then they start to have a sense of directionality. That's a kind of that's a subtle form of discrimination. Right? The mind is actually moving, grasping. So it's usually when I give instructions, I ask people to choose one. Very simple. Something they like, just look at it or hear it. And then they feel stable, calm, maybe tranquil, and joyful. And the mind is more concentrated and unified. Then it doesn't matter what sound, one will not, in Chinese we call pan yuan, grasping. So it's best to start with simple. But the natural outcome is not being swayed by all kinds of sound. So it's best to give a simple instruction first, and then people can take off and run with it or whatever.
When you said just now that if we're jumping from one sound to another and then back to what we're looking at, that it's the mind that moves. It just suddenly occurred to me. The bit in the Platform Sutra when Huineng goes to the monastery and they're debating about the flag and the wind, and he says it's your mind that moves it. This is the same.
It's kind of like that.
Okay. That's been in my head for years. It's suddenly that must be it. Okay.
It's a. It's actually discrimination.
Okay.
So it's very subtle. It's kind of pre-conceptual kind of discrimination. Conceptual would be you already formulated a word. You already formulated an idea. This is grass, and that is wind, and this is this, and this is that. It's before that, but the mind is already moving. Right? So it's selecting and picking. Right? So the mind is moving. When a person, for example, when a person comes out of maybe deep meditation state, they actually don't perceive motion. They don't think anything's moving. So Huineng's comment about the two monks arguing. One says, the flag, look, the flag is moving. And then the monk says, it's actually technically not the flag is moving. It's the wind that's blowing the flag, and logical explanations. And Huineng says, it's your mind is moving. That comment is not particularly advanced. Because even when a person comes out of a very stable, concentrated state, they can already, when they see things, things are motion, but they're not in motion. So typically when the mind is unified, they don't perceive conflict, they don't perceive movement, even though they are engaged with the world. But the unified state is a state of mind. So it comes and goes.
It doesn't stay planted there all the time.
Therefore, sooner or later, that person's mind will become distracted, I will start to make motion and distinctions. So states of mind are not the nature of mind. States of mind are like scenery, like the spaciousness of this room. States of mind are equivalent to if we clean the room, very clean and tidy, and it's very peaceful. But it has nothing to do with the nature of the room. The nature of the room is just spaciousness and openness. It just so happened that the furnitures are put clean and tidy, you see? And the room is a mess. Still doesn't have anything to do with the nature of the room. But the nature of the room is still spacious, openness. So, what Huynh then said, it's just a comment, it's a little pointer to them about their mind moving, discriminating. In the practice of silent illumination, first, one starts with relaxation, relaxing the body, establishing a good foundation in practice, right? All of us practice that. And then, one typical way is, once the body is relaxed, grounded, rooted, stable, then one continues this experiencing of sitting, this simplicity of this act of sitting. Just be aware of this act of sitting. So one uses the mind, one uses the body together. And the body is sitting, the mind is sitting. And but there will come a point in which the body, if one continues, the bodily sensations actually will start to drop away. If one sits long enough. Maybe doing a 7-day retreat or something, or long sustained practice every day. So the bodily sensation may disappear. So the first thing that disappears is the sense of your posture. The second thing that disappears is sensation, because the body is so relaxed. Haven't you relaxed so much that you don't really feel tension or pressure anywhere? Sometimes people sit, their hands disappear, or their body disappear. It's kind of like that. So, but what remains is a sense of presence, the very subtle form, like here. Because the momentum of the mind of awareness, with its object of the body, the momentum will continue. So the sense of presence of the body sitting here, maybe a subtle sense of weight or lightness here, that's still there. But if one proceeds, then very naturally, one's field of awareness start to expand beyond the boundary of the shell. Start to, when the sense faculty start to open up, and it's kind of like sounds come in, forms are seen. In the beginning, there's still kind of discrimination, grasping, subtle grasping. Because of that, one must sense directionality. Sound is coming from there, and the wind is blowing on this side. The mind still discriminates, although it's kind of a preconceptual state, but the mind is still discerning, grasping, selecting. But if one continues, start to open up, then there's no sense of directionality anymore. Then it's just the environment as a whole. Right. So that would be a deeper level. But there are many states beyond that. But all of these states are, in a sense, result of the practice being lopsided. They are kind of like altered state consciousness. They're not really pursuing the true nature of mind. Right? Lopsided means either there's more clarity or there's more kind of stability of mind when the experience of samadhi starts to emerge, then one's perceptual experience will start to be lopsided. Meaning that one will start to experience the world as maybe not moving, or no directionality, or feeling that one self, body, whatever you call it, with the environment is actually together and inseparable. So this is actually a kind of scenery, the spaciousness, right? So they may be these signposts, and the point is to keep on going, not to attach to these states, but keep on going. So they become kind of signposts in practice. It seems like stages in practice. And the reason there are stages is because they are grasping, they are attachments, and they are lopsidedness in one's practice. The identity of samadhi and prajna, that will be the nature of mind. The mind is intrinsically still, free from distraction, and yet clear. So it's not a kind of clarity gained from some kind of practice. But when it's lopsided, the concentration becomes too powerful, too strong, then our perceptions will start to change of the world. Right? So it's kind of like altered state of consciousness. I say this because a lot of people, when they come to silent illumination practice and they read some literature on it, my teacher's book, for example, or some other text, and they see these signposts, and immediately the grasping minds want to go through the ladder, go up the ladder of success. They start to go through these stages, but it's actually not necessary. It's actually not necessary, because that's just one general description of the path. Sometimes people can skip. It's not necessary that one goes for one, and then second, and then third. And sometimes people, they sit, then suddenly the body and mind drop away. And so suddenly attachment drop away. So it's no stages. There's no stages within the nature of mind. So all the different states that we experience, sometimes some insights, understanding, they're good. They help us to kind of navigate through our practice, understand a little bit more about the method, how to engage with the practice. But many times our insights and understanding, intuitive understanding, is a product of a mixture between experience and conceptual ideas. Maybe things that you have read in the past. How many of you, for example, have read some things, never really understood it, but it's very intriguing, some passages in the Dharma. And suddenly you just, only you maybe see something, or maybe like what you said about the wind moving.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly you understood. Right? It's like a flash of insight.
Mm-hmm.
Like many times this is a mixture of experience and some understanding, right? Some concept. So, but it's the same with how to ground oneself, right? In practice. It's a kind of mixture. So they help us. So it's kind of a personal experience now. It's no longer just a concept. It's mixed with your own personal experience. So it becomes a, the Dharma becomes a deeper impression. Yes, right? Helps us how to work with the matter. Yeah. But these things will come and go. Yes.
I wanted to ask, given what you just taught us, one time it was Sunday meditation, we were all sitting, and the windows were open, and the wind slammed the door shut very loud, and many of us were startled. Later, Master Jiva just said, that is a test. If you were startled, if you came out of concentration, that you weren't as deep as you should be. And I wanted to know that experience. I want to understand that experience because I still don't understand that all the way. Why he said what he said. And because anything would be startled with a big loud noise. So I'm not sure. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think you can explain it.
Okay. When one's concentration is deeper, one's absorbing the method of practice, actually one with the method, then actually it's possible that the sound becomes, or one possibility, the sound is actually very distant.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves no trace, no real impression. So you've heard it. Sometimes it seems like you heard something, retrospectively. And then, so when one's practice is very, when concentration is very delicate, you know, concentrating, and when there's tension involved in the concentration, then things can start with you. Not only door slamming, someone sneezing. So when one's concentration is relaxed, and very fascinated with the method, relaxed, appreciate your method, and working, then you won't be startled. The mind becomes more unified. So, I don't know if this is something one can understand or not. It's not like, I don't know if there's any logic to it. It's just that when the mind is absorbing something, like the method, like when there's kind of self-referentiality. Let me put it this way. Our sense of self is usually very scattered, fragmented, dependently arising from different experiences, fragmented experiences. So they kind of conflict, they're incoherent, kind of incongruent sometimes. So that would be the scattered mind. When the mind becomes concentrated, the sense of self actually becomes more simplified, unified. When one becomes unified, the sense of self only exists in the present. And the sense of self is actually very, 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 very small. Very, very small. So, distractions, oppositions, challenges, big loud noise, people arguing. You don't sense motion. You don't have a strong sense of opposition. It's almost the same as what I said before about people coming out of a unified state. They don't see motion, even though people are moving. See, it's almost like that. Because the sense of self-referentiality, kind of self, it's very small. So sound is not perceived as out there, and I'm here, and it's coming from this way. Very small. You see? So it's almost like, so the unified state is almost like the natural kind of experience of the unified state. Not only is one unified with the method, if one is kind of post-meditation time, it's coming out of meditation, because the sense of self is very, very small. Actually, it becomes blended with the external environment. It's like the external environment and you are kind of stuck together. It's like someone want to slap you in the face.
Porous.
It's porous. But let me give you an analogy. This one maybe is fun. It's a fun analogy. It's like someone want to slap you in the face. But if you're one with the hand, there's no slapping.
Yeah.
Like you and the everything around you, there's no separation. So it's
no fear.
Yeah, there's no. I mean, fear will arise because strong over here. It would arise. Something horrible happened here. So it's like if someone wants to slap you. And your face is glued to that person's, you know, palm. And when you, everything that you do post-meditation time, you do the Dharma instrument, doing chanting, or going to the toilet, or drinking water, it's like water and you and a cup, it's like the same. Right? So, it would be very difficult for the person to be kind of shocked out. Doing this and that. So it's kind of like that. Maybe that's, is that understandable?
Kind of? Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Then this is conceptual, right? But a non-conceptual way would be like when you wake up on the wrong side of the bed one day, anything can be annoying.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get on the right side of it, you feel really clean and joyful, positive. When someone steps on your foot, give you a slap, it's okay. It's kind of like that. So sounds, it's not so oppositional. So it's kind of like experiential, it would be like that. Yes?
In one of your articles that we read, you mentioned two ways of practicing, a very intense way and a more relaxed way.
Mm.
I just wonder if you could say something like, how does that work?
Okay, there's a very intense way of practicing just sitting. There's a relaxed way. Usually we don't teach the intense way. but sometimes it's required.
Like I said about,
I'm teaching you the relaxed way.
Okay.
If you were to come on a retreat with me 7 days, maybe I'll teach the tense way. But very briefly, the method is something dead. We make it alive.
Mm.
We make it alive because there's a need. We're responding to our psychophysiological situation. Sometimes a person needs to hold on to the method really tight because there's a kind of laxity, you know, laziness. So one needs to kind of urge on. Right? Today I spoke about, in practice, there is the method, which is you should know what your method is. There is the technique, which is particular angle you take on the method. I said, for those of you who are practicing just sitting, you can be aware of your posture, which will ground you in this act of sitting. You can be aware of the sense of weight. You're here, right? You're here. Or you can just be aware of the relaxation, or the all three are blending to this just sitting. Right? So this will be the technical part, right? The technicalities. Sometimes relax. But there are more than just these three. So the tense way, the relaxed way, adjust to the situation. And tense and relax also relates to the third aspect, the method, technique, and then what I spoke about.
Attitude.
Mm-hmm. It is the attitude that frames one's practice. Sometimes what it calls for is to kind of inject a small dosage of gratitude. Sit, shikang dhaza, just mind sitting, with a sense of gratitude. Even that kind of framework, that mindset frame, shifts just a little bit. It changes the experience. Doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But this afternoon, I suggest there's something else. I suggest it's contentment. Being content, to kind of cultivate this joyful and content sitting. So obstacles come, content, thank you. Satisfied. And the Buddha Dharma has many different suggestions. The Buddha has taught many suggestions for different approaches, different attitude one should take in practice. It's not just words, they're meant to be used. For example, one can also sit with a sense of not gratitude, not contentment, but a great urgency. Life is precious. Life exists in this moment. Once it passes, like our liturgy tonight, once it passes, the impermanence will never return. So that kind of earnestness, diligence, that would be like the type. So adjusting one's attitude actually changes. So
one of our last retreats, Master Jiu, actually, I didn't realize it, but he offered a similar instruction for dispelling drowsiness with a sense of
that. That's right. Sometimes my teacher came up with all kinds of stuff to dispel drowsiness. Tight. For example, one says, when you do the practice, when you're drowsy, you open your eyes, don't blink until the tears come out. Definitely, drowsiness will go away. Don't blink until tears start to come out. Right? Or he says, the fingers, dig your thumbnail right under the other thumbnail. You won't fall asleep. So that would be kind of tight. Sometimes it calls for that. If a person is perpetually, the person is not really tired, but every time after, afternoon, he's not really tired. He's just kind of lazy, always falls asleep. Then the teacher will come along. Don't sleep. Kneel on the hard floor. So you're meditating, maybe kneeling, palm joint, just sitting. In that case, it would be just kneeling. Right? So it takes a certain adjustment. Why? To navigate through different psychophysiological obstructions. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Different things that arise. So method is something very alive. We have to know how to, when to advance, when to retreat, to adjust. tune we are with our mental state, physical state, during retreat, in the rhythm of the retreat, the afternoons, late afternoons, right, or the early mornings, or the after meals, the more in tune with certain patterns. Sometimes not necessarily because you're tired, sometimes our body goes through some rhythm, some pattern. The more in tune you are with your body, the more you'll know how to navigate. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So practice like that. So the tenth way would be one, attitude shift. Two, the body strength of the sitting upright. Maybe for half a period or one whole period, because it's needed. And afterwards, you can ease up. You know, airplanes, when it takes off, it takes a lot of effort. Mm. Once it's airborne, it seems like it's, you know, smooth sailing. Or, you know, pushing a boat off a dock, you gotta kind of row really hard. Once it's in the lake, it's just kind of, you can let it flow. So sometimes, depending on different people, sometimes you need to give it a nice push first. But you have to be very skillful, because you have to be very honest, and you must come from direct perception, understanding of your psychophysiological state. It can't come from vexations. It can't come from vexations. What is that? Grasping and rejecting, seeking for some state, and trying to reject other state. For example, a person practiced a tight method, adjusting. And that's because maybe the person is lazy, is not really tired. So through your own discernment, you have to see, is tired, fatigued, or just lazy, or it's just the rhythm, the pattern in the body. You don't necessarily have to follow that. You can break through from the old habits. Right? Or is it because, you know, I want enlightenment? I want some good state, because the last period I sat very well. Why can't I do it now? Or, and then you try, got the vexations. Mm-hmm. Then it become a vicious cycle. You're actually fatigued, but you don't know. And you push through. Right? So you become more tired. Mm-hmm. So you become sleepy afterwards. Afterwards, sleepy, you feel guilty. Mm-hmm. Right? And then you try to work hard again. Right? So it becomes a vicious cycle between tension, sleepy. Tension, sleepy. Tension, sleepy. Mm-hmm. That person is not skillful. So you have to be a skillful practitioner. Does that make sense?
Yes. For me, I was practicing attention to the mind, and sometimes I felt sleepy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met Chin Sasi, he told me to first to stay, stand up, and to sometimes
afternoon
in morning, and then when feeling hot or warm, he left.
Mm-hmm.
And then he and it taught me not to sleep anymore.
Yeah.
So I can become meditation better.
Yeah. There's a lot of different expedient means, a lot of different methods.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he taught you at that time. You can use it. Sometimes we also recommend people, the thing with drowsiness is sometimes as a long time practitioner or someone who's practiced a lot, they may become, when they sit, it becomes a habit, because they're not really attached to this or that. The grasping mind is no longer there. But the motivation is also gone with the grasping mind. You know, so that kind of urgency, right? So, or it's just because of physical conditions. A person's physical conditions. In order to break out of this pattern, you know, doing something with the eyes, or you know, having the incense stick monitor come around to help you with the stick, or using the thumb. Sometimes those don't even work. Sometimes those don't even work. So what needs to be done is actually stand up. So sometimes I ask people to just stand up behind their seat, very quietly, and just stand up. And just join the palms. It's a lot harder to stand up and fall down. So it's a lot harder. Most time people. And then when they stand up, they will just see this, that previous period of drowsiness just gone. It's like a dream. It's not there. Maybe they thought I was tired, but when they stand up, it's just, you know, what they move. So sometimes it involves more kind of physiological antidote. Another thing that I suggest, which all of you can try, is this. Instead of standing up, I usually reserve for no matter what, the person cannot come up. This is another method. So when we sit, our left hand is on top, right? Is it hard to fall asleep while you do walking meditation? It is?
It's hard to fall asleep walking.
Yeah, it's hard to fall asleep. Right? You take a step and collapse. It's hard. Right? So the principle, same principle. You have to be in motion. How do we do be in motion when we sit? Do this. Can't stop. Even though the movements are slow, it's continuous. Because if you stop, it will fall asleep again. So, first left hand, and then right hand. And on the way back, is right hand first. Let's try together. And then the hands. So let's put the hands in the meditation posture. Now raise your left hand to the level of your chest slowly. And then glide your hands across, palms up. When you get right over your knees, turn the palm to the side. And then down. And then when you touch your knees, palms down to your knees. And the right hand. The level of the chest, glide over above the knees. Turn your palm to the side, down the hand. Once you touch your knees, place your palm over the knees. And then the right hand, put the palm on the side, raise your hand over your knees, turn your palm up. Glide over to in front of your chest, lower, let it rest on your lap. Left hand, palms to the side. Raise it above your knees. Turn the palms upward. Glide it across in front of your chest. to rest on your right palm, the two thumbs gently touch. Feel the sensations there. And then repeat. So continuous for a whole period. You can do that. Harder. In the beginning, maybe you need to do, because the drowsiness is very strong, maybe you need to do it a little bit quicker. As the drowsiness dissipates, your sensation of your palm will become more acute. There's a lot of capillaries on your fingers. Sensations on your palm is very strong. You can actually, as your drowsiness dispels, as you move your palm, you can actually feel the different sensation on the palm, coolness of the palm gliding, and the back of the hand, it's actually two different sensations. So the sensations become stronger and stronger and stronger until drowsiness completely dissipates. And then the last movement, down, left on top of right, two thumbs touching, and you just stay there. And you just continue to sit. Right? So sometimes, this morning, someone asked, this lady asked, can I feel the weight of the left palm? You remember that?
Yeah.
I said, you don't have to feel the weight there. Don't put the weight there, but feel the sensation there. Same thing, when the last movement ends, you just let it rest there. That's actually another way of doing just sitting. Right? So, Master, Zen Master Yingshan, or Keizang, that's the way he taught it. He's kind of second generation of his teacher, Dogen. So, just put it there. And you put a sense of center of gravity kind of there. But that's one way that he taught. All of these are just different variations, different techniques, you see? The basic method is just sitting, and then you have these different variation technique. And then the third aspect is the attitude that frames the experience.
The master also told me on the last day of the retreat when I was getting sleepy, he told me to bring more energy and breath into my head.
Yeah.
It didn't really work for me, but maybe I didn't understand it fully.
The reason one is drowsy is because the energy is too settled. The energy is too low. So you need to bring your energy up. Right? So one way to bring it up, I don't know exactly his instruction, but the principle is the same, bring your energy up. One way I teach people to bring your energy up very quickly is, you know, the energy is too low, you're drowsy, you're too settled, right? You sit correctly. Open your mouth, take an inhale, like this. As wide as you can, try that. Not making sounds, wide as you can. You see how quickly the clarity just shoots up there.
Mm-hmm.
Lack of oxygen, basically, the problem with that is just lack of oxygen, because it's just too low, too low, too low.
That's
what's
the air from the only opening?
Only open and take air.
Ah, take
air. To get the oxygen to the brain. You get the oxygen to the brain. Lack of oxygen to the brain, then drowsiness. So, very quickly. No drowsy. Right. But this is a temporary.
Mm.
It's a temporary fix. It will come back. It's best to just, you know, stand up or, you know, do something if it's very strong. if it's just a little bit, you know, like this, or my teacher's way, which is open your eyes wide and don't blink until your tears come out, then the energy will come right up. Your eyes are. And then, you know, you go back, relax the eyes. See? Sometimes people, a more subtle way is tucking your chin and feel the tightness, tautness in the back of the head. If the drowsiness just a little bit. Or just like this. Just rotate your neck. Get the blood flow again. Get the oxygen flow. Raise the shoulders, back, that helps too, right? Then the energy goes up. Okay. So originally I was going to talk about some formal teaching on the Om Sutra. But I was going to use this as a stepping stone to talk about. But maybe not necessary. Maybe not necessary. Maybe tomorrow we can talk about it. Okay? Especially in the deal with the questions that you may have.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
So you mentioned that after the meditation, kind of like the mind is in a type of state that it's very stable, so things or sounds or any phenomena come and go through, it doesn't affect, even though I know that it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Those type of state, it's just like any type of state of the mind doesn't last.
It doesn't last.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but in that state, there are some advantage. For example, I won't waste my energy just doing whatever I'm supposed to do, useless things. So,
yeah.
I wonder if, I know this is probably wrong, but if I want to at least
elongate that state.
Yeah, because I know it eventually gone, and then I cannot control when it comes, when it's not every time after meditation.
Mm.
I can experience that. But I think it's I know it's a judgment, but I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Better than wondering about or blogging.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want
to elongate that,
should
I just keep practicing and wait it? Or it's just, cannot be waited, then I have expectation. But if it occurs, it occurs. What is the right attitude to
choose? Let it go. If you want
to elongate it, make it last, make it come back. That's vexations. Mm-hmm. When vexation is the cause. The result of vexations, cause and effect, it will never come back. It's not something that you can elongate. It's not something that you can make it last. It's a scenery. It's like when you walk from point A to point B, you start walking, and you see natural scenery. So you can't wish for it. They're kind of like sideshow. Even though I know what you're saying, even though at least it's better than having wandering thoughts, right? But we're not so bad at wandering thoughts. That view of this is better than that needs to be corrected. Because in the spaciousness of this room, this furniture and that furniture is not one better than the other, or no furniture. It doesn't affect your true nature, so practice based on correct view. Practice based on true nature. Not grasp, not reject. Then the cause is like this, the effect will correspond. If we practice based on gaining and losing, good and bad. And the effect is like a roller coaster ride, good, bad, good, bad. Gaining, losing, gaining, losing. It's not so good. And your practice becomes a kind of substitution. I want to substitute this with that, because that's better than this. It's, you know, then it's a game. It becomes kind of spiritual materialism, just kind of substitute worldly stuff with the spiritual stuff. Not Buddha Dharma practice, not Chan practice. So that very thinking, when you have this kind of thinking, let it go. Just be in the present, using the method. That's it. Safer.
But then, why do we even come to the cushion? If you say gain and loss, obviously there are days you don't want to sit, but you come to the cushion, you think there is a gain. So even the whole purpose of being here, there's a gain. Mm-hmm. You have experience in the past and you come back for that. So
when we are on the method, when we are actually engaged in practice, no gain, no loss. No gain, no loss. When we aspire to practice, for example, every year we only get one vacation week off, we look forward to one retreat. We aspire to practice because we know where we're at and what needs to be done. What needs to be done is we have to learn. We have to learn Dharma. So the correct aspiration to practice, that's not vexatious. That's wholesome Dharma. You see? But once we engage in practice, you have to drop that. You have to drop that. When you're formally meditating, when you're in the retreat, that's why I said this morning, past, future, words, language, environment, the body, everything. Put in your garbage bag and put it outside. Pick it up later. See, once we're here, it's a rare opportunity to actually practice that. So practice to be in alignment with our true nature, essentially. And then when we become more familiar with it, then we will become aware of to what extent we're always grasping and rejecting, grasping in daily life, which is the cause of our suffering, cause and effect. Right? And then the more we practice, the more we understand, we can be more in tune with our mind, our body, our habit, patterns, then we can recognize it, then we can learn to let that go. Then our daily life, less vexations. So practice is necessary. Practice is necessary. I have a more realistic view of practice. And that is, yes, we all have Buddha nature. Yes. We're intrinsically awake. Yes, there's no gain and loss. Nothing to attain, like the Harsha. Yes, that's correct. It's not my experience. That's the Buddha's experience. So we practice. You see? To that correct aspiration. That's why we make Bodhisattva vows. Vow to save all beings. Isn't that kind of desire? Isn't that kind of gain? Vow to cut off vexations. Isn't that? No, that's correct Dharma. that's a compass that directs us what needs to be done. Right. In order to save all beings, what do we have to do? Lessen our vexations. Otherwise, every being you try to help with your vexation, with your vexing mind, a problem. Right. How do we lessen vexations? We practice Dharma, innumerable Dharma, method, technique, attitude, all the variations, very skillfully, that's practicing innumerable Dharma. mastering. So we become Buddha. All beings already saved. Yet, our actions help them. We don't think, I'm helping them. See how good I am helping them. See, in the perspective of the Buddha, all beings already saved. The Buddha vowed to save all beings. And Gautama became a Buddha. For him, all beings saved. If there's still the other, being so suffering, painful, that's like a mirror, feeling sorry for the person standing in front. No, I want to reflect that, I don't want to reflect this. The mirror. No image, all beings saved. You see? But in order to do that, we have to have a correct compass to practice. We make vows. We come to retreats. We engage in practice. While we're practicing, we learn to not grasp, not reject. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something else that you wrote in one of the things of yours that I read recently is that instead of seeing myself as a bodhisattva, I view other people as bodhisattvas helping me. I can't remember the context exactly. Mm-hmm. That was you, wasn't it?
Yeah, all beings are bodhisattvas. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but it just struck me in a way that was you know, de-emphasized my vows, you know, what I'm supposed to do, but to rather shift the focus to how I am being helped and how I am being
My teacher used to say this to me. He says, he used to say, all beings have kind of upside down thinking. Topsy-turvy. 颠倒梦想, upside down. Buddha Dharma turns it right side up. It's usually complete different view than ordinary worldly consideration. So when we encounter difficulties, when we encounter interact with living beings, sentient beings, and all that. One way to use the Dharma is turn our thinking upside down, or rather, right side up. If we tend to think, I'm saving beings, I'm helping, that's most likely probably samsara thinking. See? So in order to turn the situation around, right side up, the Bodhisattva thinks, all beings are Bodhisattvas. Thank you for the opportunity. Then probably you're practicing according to the Dharma. So practitioners, we don't apply this to other people. Like, hey, you're thinking upside down. This is not, it's not meant to do that. It's meant to apply to ourselves. When we encounter difficulties in life, when we encounter challenges, and your kind of gut reaction, you're thinking, is probably upside down. Self-referential. So, how to use the Buddha Dharma to make the Buddha Dharma come alive in us, turn the right side up. Then you're probably practicing. Isn't that an easy principle to use, to remember? This person's harmful to me, this colleague, or this co-worker, isn't that? Oh, great. Free lessons in patience. You can't even agree about to pay for this person. I'm on retreat. My co-worker. Turn your upside down view right side up. Okay? Release from this self-referential view. Response to that. I probably said that coming from that. That's how I practice. My teacher taught me. Because even when I said, what is the mind for the way? Daoxin. His reply was, remember? Body like a rag, mind like a mirror. Because ordinary people, the body is very precious. You've got to take care of the body. You know, when they do retreats, they want to save a little energy because we still have the afternoon left. We still have tomorrow left. So it's preserving, you know, cherishing. You see? Upside down. The mind is not like a mirror. The mind is, they think when they experience good things, they think their mind is like a beacon, an illuminating light. And some people, when they practice silent illumination, they think they're trying very hard to emit light. I think it's funny, but actually some people, it's like illumination. They think they're the center of the world, illuminating everyone. Right? No, you're not. Right? We're not. You see? So all beings provide the context for our practice. A lot of things to be grateful to. Right? So all the virtues that the Buddha taught are actually stemming spontaneously, naturally, out of the selfless mind. Selflessness. It's not a commandment, nor is it some kind of ideal. When a person's sense of self is very small or absent, the natural response to the world is gratitude. It's natural. Humility. Not self-disparaging. Humility. Naturally, like my teacher, for example, naturally is environmental protection. To protect the environment. Naturally, like our evening service, to be frugal. It's natural. It's not an ideal. You have to think up, what is a good idea to propagate the Dharma? It's a very natural thing. You appreciate all things, all beings. So naturally, you won't waste stuff. But when you clean during mindful work period, how many of you use paper towels to clean? No? Okay. Good. Yeah. Or you use rags, cloth. Oh, good. You know, some people they use good towel. They use a little bit, they throw it away. Right? So naturally, you save it. For next time, until it's completely cannot use anymore. You can dry it and you can still use it, you know, naturally. To be grateful of the environment, natural resources, to be grateful to all those who support the practice. When we come here, they lay out the cushions away. And our teachers provide a facility to practice, working very hard. Wow, so naturally, so gratitude. But when the self is very strong, very big, we can't see that. When the self is quieted, we actually see all the things that are helping us. This is a very spontaneous thing. So, that's the wonderful thing about Buddha Dharma. It's alive, it's very organic. And it's about our experience. Okay. So, even though I'm here to introduce silent illumination, same thing when we talk about the method, it's very organic, it's very alive. Just by shifting our attitude, just a bit, changes the context. When we are more concentrated, our sense of self, which is scattered, becomes diminished. When we are more unified, it becomes small. And naturally, you know, the gratitude arises. Humility arises. Gratefulness or joy arises. So that provides the context for just mind seeing, 只观打坐。So it's meant for all of us to use to make it come alive. Okay? And I'll take one more question and we'll conclude tonight. Oh, please.
No, okay. Well, you just mentioned the word again.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking that the method that the silent illumination is a product of the Chinese culture. In a way, because I remember I heard somebody describe the difference between the Indian culture and Chinese culture. Both are very, thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that, I think it's a DT, the Japanese.
DT Suzuki.
Right, I think he mentioned something like the Indian culture is very beautiful, a lot of celestial figures, very imaginative.
Mm-hmm.
So the scripture and the method of practicing meditation is a result of their cultural background. And so the very step 1, 2, 3, 4, milestone 1, 2, 3, 4, it's all systematic and all that. However, the method that you just taught us, and you mentioned that it's a product of 600 years, 6th century, that kind of stuff, And it's a product of all these people in that, even more than that, It's a long history of the cultivation under the Chinese culture. And the reason it paused in Japan, because Japan is also an Asian country. So its culture is somewhat similar to the Chinese culture. So the question I want to ask is that here we are in the United States, and the Americans are open, they only have 200 years of history, and it's a melting pot of every culture that you can imagine in the world is all here. So I'm thinking that is there another meditation that's custom made for people in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
So that we can accept them, unless we like to have, because I was not born in the U.S., but I've been in the U.S. for 40 years, so kind of like that. My mind is kind of geared towards it. So I'm thinking that if we just, I don't want to use this word, but it's kind of like a push into the book, with this Indian way of doing things and Chinese way of doing things. Is there a way of doing things so that it will be easily acceptable, or not acceptable, but easily comprehensible? I mean, feel like a homegrown? Is there some kind of meditation that you can think of?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can marry those two, marry the Indian and the Chinese and sprinkle some American into it.
I don't want to think about it. If you want to think about it, you can think about it. For the retreat, the most important thing is practice. Theoretical questions. It's nice to entertain, but it's not something that we can think of. Neither did the Indian patriarchs nor the Chinese thought up, invented this method. It's just something that will naturally emerge, you see?
Mm.
So as long as people practice Dharma, it will manifest. You see? It's like a plant. You don't know what kind of seed it is in the soil. All you have to do is plant a seed. You can't think about it. You put the seed in the soil. You add water, give it sunshine, you take care of it. When it blossoms, as it blossoms, then its identity will reveal itself. You know what I'm saying? In a new soil, in a new land. It's not so, if I strategically this, because it's a modern thing, it's maybe science, okay? Scientific, that has to be one ingredient. And then, people are very independent, it doesn't come that way. Right? It's best to apply for the Dharma ourselves and see how it blossoms.
Mm.
So, the Dharma, we hear the Dharma, whatever Dharma we hear, we use it. We make it come alive. And you will see what kind of flower it blossoms in you. We all know that. We have to see. Right? Any Dharma. If we have to wait till the right one, forget it. Forget it. Shakyamuni Buddha, in his previous life, the one anecdote. Devas was trying to test Shakyamuni Buddha's diligence in practice in the Dharma. And manifested as a demon. This is ascetic practice. And the demon says, standing on top of a tree looking at this ascetic. Actually, he's a god. All things are impermanent. And he's Shakyamuni Buddha before in the previous life. He heard that. Who said that? All things are impermanent. Just has a ring of truth to it. This is the Dharma. Oh, I did. I heard it from my previous Buddha. But I'm very hungry now. I want some flesh. Would you offer me your flesh? And then I'll give you the second one that I heard. Gautama, how would I know if I offer you my voice that you will actually say the second line? He says, don't worry, you have my word. Now climb up on the tree like a nice man, and I will have my mouth open with my jaw catching you as you come down. I will give you the second Dharma line. He says, it's worthwhile, the Dharma, to practice now, to hear it. Even upon hearing it, I die. At least I die hearing it. He says, okay, climb on a tree. Jumps off. Okay, the first line is, all things are impermanent. I may not remember exact wording or something like this, right? All things are impermanent. As you jump off, that which arises and perishes, when that which arises and perishes ceases to be, nirvana is bliss. So all things arise and perish, arise and perish, arise and perish, all things are impermanent. When that which arises and perishes ceases, that is nirvana. He heard a great elation as he landed on a lotus. The Deva says, oh, just testing you. So the story, the moral detail is, it's best to whatever Dharma that we hear, apply, make it come alive. Give it water, give it nourishment. Let it blossom within you. It becomes personal experience. Right? Don't wait. In case you're waiting. Don't wait. Don't wait. Right. Okay. We take a short break and we come back. Sit. I'll do a little guided meditation into silent meditation. Thank you. Thank you.